Chapter 7. The letter to the sergeant of the guard, and that ultimately it had reached the hands of our generalissimo. His excellency had deigned to take cognizance of it with his own eyes. After that he had referred the matter in confidence to General Robles. The letter, senors, I cannot now recollect textually. I saw the signature of Gasparuz. He was an audacious fellow. He had snatched a soul for himself out of a cataclysm, remember. And now it was that soul which had dictated the terms of his letter. Its tone was very independent. I remember it struck me at the time as noble, dignified. It was, no doubt, her letter. Now I shudder at the depth of its duplicity. Gasparuz was made to complain of the injustice, of which he had been a victim. He invoked his previous record of fidelity and courage. Having been saved from death by the miraculous interposition of Providence, he could think of nothing but of retrieving his character. This, he wrote, he could not hope to do in the ranks as a discredited soldier still under suspicion. He had the means to give a striking proof of his fidelity. He had ended by proposing to the general-in-chief a meeting at midnight in the middle of the plaza, before the Moneda. The signal would be to strike fire with flint and steel 3 times, which was not too conspicuous, and yet distinctive enough for recognition. San Martin, the great liberator, loved men of audacity and courage. Besides, he was just and compassionate. I told him as much of the man's story as I knew, and was ordered to accompany him on the appointed night. The signals were duly exchanged. It was midnight, and the whole town was dark and silent. Their two cloaked figures came together in the center of the vast plaza, and, keeping discreetly at a distance, I listened for an hour or more to the murmur of their voices. Then the general motioned me to approach, and as I did, so I heard San Martin, who was courteous to gentle and simple alike, offer Gasparuz the hospitality of the headquarters for the night. But the soldier refused, saying that he would be not worthy of that honor till he had done something. You cannot have a common deserter for your guest, Excellency, apostrophe he protested with a low laugh, and stepping backwards merged slowly into the night. The commander-in-chief observed to me, as we turned away. He had somebody with him, our friend Ruz. I saw two figures for a moment. It was an unobtrusive companion. Apostrophe apostrophe, I too, had observed another figure join the vanishing form of Gasparuz. It had the appearance of a short fellow in a poncho and a big hat. And I wondered stupidly who it could be he had dared take into his confidence. I might have guessed it could be no one, but that fatal girl, alas! Where he kept her concealed I do not know. He had, it was known afterwards, an uncle, his mother's brother, a small shopkeeper in Santiago. Perhaps it was there that she found a roof and food. Whatever she found, it was poor enough to exasperate her pride and keep up her anger and hate. It is certain she did not accompany him on the feat he undertook to accomplish first of all. It was nothing less than the destruction of a store of war material collected secretly by the Spanish authorities in the south, in a town called Liners. Gasparuz was entrusted with a small party only, but they proved themselves worthy of San Martin's confidence. The season was not propitious. They had to swim swollen rivers. They seemed, however, to have galloped night and day out riding the news of their foray, and holding straight for the town, 100 miles into the enemy's country, till at break of day they rode into it sword in hand, surprising the little garrison. It fled without making a stand, leaving most of its officers in Gasparuz's hands. A great explosion of gunpowder ended the conflagration of the magazines the raiders had set on fire without loss of time. In less than 6 hours they were riding away at the same mad speed, without the loss of a single man. Good as they were, such an exploit is not performed without a still better leadership. I was dining at the headquarters, when Gasparuz himself brought the news of his success. And it was a great blow to the royalist troops. For a proof he displayed to us the garrison's flag. He took it from under his poncho and flung it on the table. The man was transfigured. There was something exulting and menacing in the expression of his face. He stood behind General San Martin's chair and looked proudly at us all. He had a round blue cap etched with silver braid on his head, and we all could see a large white scar on the nape of his sunburned neck. Somebody asked him what he had done with the captured Spanish officers. He shrugged his shoulders scornfully. What a question to ask. In a partisan war you do not burden yourself with prisoners. I let them go, and here are their sword knots. He flung a bunch of them on the table upon the flag. Then General Robles, whom I was attending there, spoke up in his loud thick voice. You did. Then, my brave friend, you do not know yet how a war like ours ought to be conducted. You should have done this. And he passed the edge of his hand across his own throat. Alas, sinners! It was only too true that on both sides this contest, in its nature so heroic, was stained by ferocity. The murmurs that arose at General Robles' words were by no means unanimous in tone. But the generous and brave San Martin praised the humane action, and pointed out to Ruse a place on his right hand. Then rising with a full glass he proposed a toast. Caballeros and comrades in arms, let us drink the health of Captain Gaspar Ruse. And when we had emptied our glasses, the commander-in-chief continued, to entrust him with the guardianship of our southern frontier, while we go afar, to liberate our brethren in Peru. He whom the enemy could not stop from striking a blow at his very heart will know how to protect the peaceful populations we leave behind us to pursue our sacred task. And he embraced the silent Gaspar Ruse by his side. Later on, when we all rose from table, I approached the latest officer of the army with my congratulations. And, Captain Ruse, I added, perhaps you do not mind telling a man who has always believed in the uprightness of your character what became of Don Herminia on that night. At this friendly question his aspect changed. He looked at me from under his eyebrows with the heavy, dull glance of a gasso of a peasant. Senor Tenient, he said, thickly, and as if very much cast down, do not ask me about the Senorita, for I prefer not to think about her at all when I am amongst you. He looked, with a frown, all about the room, full of smoking and talking officers. Of course I did not insist. These, sinners, were the last words I was to hear him utter for a long, long time. The very next day we embarked for our arduous expedition to Peru, and we only heard of Gaspar Ruse's doings in the midst of battles of our own. He had been appointed military guardian of our southern province. He raised a partida. But his leniency to the conquered foe displeased the civil governor, who was a formal, uneasy man, full of suspicions. He forwarded reports against Gaspar Ruse to the supreme government, one of them being that he had married publicly, with great pomp, a woman of royalist tendencies. Quarrels were sure to arise between these two men of very different character. At last the civil governor began to complain of his inactivity, and to hint at treachery, which, he wrote, would be not surprising in a man of such antecedents. Gaspar Ruse heard of it. His rage flamed up, and the woman ever by his side, knew how to feed it with perfidious words. I do not know whether really the supreme government ever did as he complained afterwards send orders for his arrest. It seems certain that the civil governor began to tamper with his officers, and that Gaspar Ruse discovered the fact. One evening, when the governor was giving a tertulia, Gaspar Ruse, followed by six men he could trust, appeared riding through the town to the door of the government house, and entered the sala armed, his hat on his head. As the governor, displeased, advanced to meet him, he seized the wretched man round the body, carried him off from the midst of the appalled guests, as though he were a child, and flung him down the outer steps into the street. An angry hug from Gasparu's was enough to crush the life out of a giant. But in addition, Gasparu's horsemen fired their pistols at the body of the governor as it lay motionless at the bottom of the stairs. X, after this, as he called an act of justice, Ruz crossed the Rio Blanco, followed by the greater part of his band, and entrenched himself upon a hill. A company of regular troops sent out foolishly against him was surrounded and destroyed almost to a man. Other expeditions, though better organized, were equally unsuccessful. It was during these sanguinary skirmishes that his wife first began to appear on horseback at his right hand. Rendered proud and self-confident by his successes, Ruz no longer charged at the head of his partida, but presumptuously, like a general directing the movements of an army, he remained in the rear, well mounted and motionless on an eminence, sending out his orders. She was seen repeatedly at his side, and for a long time was mistaken for a man. There was much talk then of a mysterious white-faced chief, to whom the defeats of our troops were ascribed. She rode like an Indian woman, astride, wearing a broad-brimmed man's hat and a dark poncho. Afterwards, in the day of their greatest prosperity, this poncho was embroidered in gold, and she wore then, also, the sword of poor Don Antonio de Leyva. This veteran Chilean officer, having the misfortune to be surrounded with his small force, and running short of ammunition, found his death at the hands of the Arauco Indians, the allies and auxiliaries of Gasparu's. This was the fatal affair long remembered afterwards as the massacre of the island. The sword of the unhappy officer was presented to her by Panilio, the Araucanian chief. For these Indians, struck by her aspect, the deathly pallor of her face, which no exposure to the weather seemed to affect, and her calm indifference under fire, looked upon her as a supernatural being, or at least as a witch. By this superstition, the prestige and authority of Gasparu's amongst these ignorant people were greatly augmented. She must have savored her vengeance to the full on that day, when she buckled on the sword of Don Antonio de Leyva. It never left her side, unless she put on her woman's clothes, not that she would or could ever use it, but she loved to feel it beating upon her thigh as a perpetual reminder and symbol of the dishonor to the arms of the Republic. She was insatiable. Moreover, on the path as he had led Gasparu's upon, there is no stopping. Escaped prisoners, and they were not many, used to relate how with a few whispered words she could change the expression of his face, and revive his flagging animosity. They told how after every skirmish, after every raid, after every successful action, he would ride up to her, and look into her face. Its haughty calm was never relaxed. Her embrace, sinners, must have been as cold as the embrace of a statue. He tried to melt her icy heart in a stream of warm blood. Some English naval officers who visited him at that time noticed the strange character of his infatuation. At the movement of surprise and curiosity in his audience, General Santiera paused for a moment. "Yes, English naval officers," he repeated. "Our Ruz had consented to receive them to arrange for the liberation of some prisoners of your nationality. In the territory upon which he ranged, from sea coast to the Cordillera, there was a bay, where the ships of that time, after rounding Cape Horn, used to resort for wood and water. There, decoying the crew on shore, he captured first the whaling brig Hersalia, and afterwards made himself master by surprise of two more ships, one English and one American. It was rumored at the time that he dreamed of setting up a navy of his own. But that, of course, was impossible. Still, manning the brig with part of her own crew, and putting an officer and a good many men of his own on board, he sent her off to the Spanish governor of the island of Chilo with a report of his exploits, and a demand for assistance in the war against the rebels. The governor could not do much for him, but he sent in return two light field pieces, a letter of compliments, with a colonel's commission in the royal forces, and a great Spanish flag. This standard, with much ceremony, was hoisted over his house in the heart of the Arauco country. Surely on that day she may have smiled on her Gasso husband with a less haughty reserve. The senior officer of the English squadron on our coast made representations to our government as to these captures. But Gasparuz refused to treat with us. Then an English frigate proceeded to the bay, and her captain, doctor, and two lieutenants traveled inland under a safe conduct. They were well received, and spent 3 days as guests of the partisan chief. A sort of military barbaric state was kept up at the residence. It was furnished with the loot of frontier towns. When first admitted to the principal sala, they saw his wife lying down. She was not in good health then, with Gasparuz sitting at the foot of the couch. His hat was lying on the floor, and his hands reposed on the hilt of his sword. During that first conversation he never removed his big hands from the sword hilt, except once, to arrange the coverings about her, with gentle, careful touches. They noticed that whenever she spoke he would fix his Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.